Good evening, everyone. Good to see all of you tonight. We're going to be having some fun tonight, that I can guarantee. We're going to be doing the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is not the actual Dead Sea Scrolls. But we're going to be studying about the Dead Sea Scrolls tonight as part of our continuing discussion of the important literature, the important works that, in fact, were written between the times of Tanakh and the beginning of Sarim, the beginning of Chazal, the writings of our rabbis. And what we found, and we're continue to find, this is the most recent find, is that there was a lot that was written during that time, even if it never became part of our canon of religious literature. But there is a great deal of wealth that we can glean from this literature, not just from a historical perspective and other perspectives we're going to talk about, but for a religious perspective as well, from a Jewish traditional perspective, there is quite a lot that we do learn from these sources and that we can benefit from their study. Of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that this course is coming in between our very successful class last year of Tanakh B'Shana, and the course we're going to be doing this coming year of Sfarim B'Shana. In Tanakh B'Shana last year, we really were overwhelmed by the amount of interest and excitement that that class created and the enjoyment that people had who partook of the class, and so we're going to be doing it again next year, studying all of the books of Tanakh in the course of 1 year. It's a great opportunity. If you haven't done it, do it. There are sign-up sheets outside. If you want more information, there's more information outside. That's going to be next year on Tuesday nights. We're launching a new course that we're creating right here, Sfarim B'Shana. We're going to study the most influential books, Jewish books written over the past 2,000 years as they pertain to Jewish law, Jewish thought, and Jewish biblical studies. And so that's going to be a fantastic course that's been created in cooperation with Dr. Lauren Schiffman, from the Director of Judaic Studies at New York University. It's going to be a fantastic course. What can I say? It's a be a worthwhile use of your time. That'll be on Wednesday nights. In fact, we're going to be referring to Lauren Schiffman quite a bit tonight in our class. So keep that in mind. Again, the information on all those classes available outside. You're always welcome to give me a call if you want to discuss those courses further. But tonight, I want to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dead Sea Scrolls, one could argue, and probably very strongly argue, is the most important discovery of the past century. And there's been numerous discoveries, but this is probably the most important archaeological discovery of the past century. It has added such a wealth of information, given us so much insight, so much understanding of a world gone by. See movies of treasure explorers, where they go and they find a treasure, a room, a cavern from thousands of years ago, and what it would be like to really find a living document from thousands of years ago into insight into a world that we barely even knew existed, let alone fully appreciated. In fact, that's what the Dead Sea Scrolls are. These are the last remnants of a community that existed over 2,000 years ago in the land of Israel, in Judea, in the Judean desert. The amount of information that we've learned from it has been spectacular, and that study has really only begun. There's still quite a lot more research to be done. It's probably one of the most expansive, one of the freshest fields in Judaic studies that exists, because there is such a wealth of information, so much deeper penetrating understanding that we'll continue to get from researching and understanding those topics. And it impacts so many different areas. It's a breadth of areas, whether it's dealing simply with history, understanding, appreciating the events that took place at that time, whether we look at appreciating religion at that time, both the religion of the Dead Sea Scroll community, which we'll talk about, or what it teaches us about broader religion at that time, issues of theology, what people actually believed during that time period. It has shared with us quite a lot of information on language, what type of Hebrew, what type of language was spoken at that time, what was their form of writing, what type of lettering did they use. There's different types of Hebrew lettering, so from that we see the types of letter that was used. It can help with phonetics, it helps quite a lot with our understanding of religion, of language, from the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then it tells us a lot about the people that live there. It tells about their lifestyle, the way that they conducted their lives, even down to the materials that they used, the way that they built their homes, and so on. So many different fields have been impacted and are really quite excited about the opportunities that the Dead Sea Scroll has brought to their fields, and giving us a much more profound understanding of that time period in so many, really many, many different ways.
Apologies.
No problem. So that's what we need to talk about. We need to talk about these Dead Sea Scrolls and to get an appreciation of them. You may have, in your readings, come across Dead Sea Scrolls and have an opportunity to already have an inkling of what they're about, where they're from, and so on. But one of the things that I want to do, and sort of following in what we've been doing in the classes until now, is, yeah, there's a lot out there about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but what I uniquely want to talk about with you is how the Dead Sea Scrolls impact our knowledge of Judaism, how it impacts Judaic studies. And so sort of taking a unique perspective or a unique angle at interpreting the scrolls, our angle is, you know, what does it teach us about areas that are relevant to Jewish life as it relates to what did Judaism look like at that time? What does it teach us about the history of that time? What does it teach us about the Jewish religion now? What does it teach us about Tanakh? And so on. Those are the types of things that I want to explore with you in this class. One of the things we're going to be looking at, and we're going to get a better, more precise appreciation of it, is exactly when these scrolls are from. But without getting into it now, we're going to talk about it in a little bit, is they're over 2,000 years old. They predate Korban Bayit Sheni. They predate the destruction of the Second Temple. They're from the Second Temple period. And so they're quite ancient. They were lost. They were lost. They were hidden in a mountain, or in a series of hills, for 2,000 years. They're preserved, untouched, for a very long time. Nobody knew about them. Nobody knew that they existed. Nobody knew that a community had ever lived there. It simply was tucked away in some desert somewhere. And for all they think about, all the things that have happened in Israel over the last 2,000 years, all the changes of power and this community coming, that community going, the wars and the battles, this has been passed over, right? These was something that lay hidden, buried in a mountain for 2,000 years, only to start to be discovered in 1948. What's interesting is we had found some of the scrolls without knowing it already in an earlier time. In the early part of the 20th century, there was another major discovery that took place. That was that of the Geniza, that of the discovery of the burial place of Jewish books in Cairo, the Cairo Geniza. And at the time they found many interesting writings and so on, writings of the Rambam. You can actually go to the Jewish Theological Seminary today and actually see something the Rambam wrote with his own two hands, and you can see his signature at the bottom of it. So they found lots of incredible things there, and they in fact found one document which was known as the Damascus document that dealt with eschatological, something like that. Yes, exactly. Discussions of the wars between good and bad, evil, the sons of light and darkness. And it was identified, it was in the Geniza, as some type of Jewish writing. Solomon Schechter published it in 1910, but nobody really knew what it was. It clearly wasn't traditional Jewish literature. Somebody had preserved it for 1,000 years. The Geniza's from about 1,000 years ago, but nobody really knew what it was. Until they found the Dead Sea Scroll documents and found that same document among the finds of Qumran. And they realized that for whatever reason, that document had made it. And for whatever reason, had been continued to be transcribed by somebody, who knows, maybe Karaites, unclear, over the centuries, and somehow found its way into the Geniza. But the real discovery, right, the real find of the Dead Sea Scrolls didn't take place until 1948. As the story goes, there was a Bedouin that was out grazing his sheep on the Judean hills, and he had his trusted goat there helping him with the grazing, and his goat ran off. And he saw his goat, you know, climbing up some hill, going to a cave. So he goes ahead, he takes his rock, and he throws it, right, he throws it into the cave, hoping the noise will scare his goat out. Well, it did scare him out, but it scared him too. The rock, he heard it go into this hill, and he heard something shatter, right? He heard something break. He was scared. He didn't know, demons, what's going on there? He leaves. He leaves at that time and comes back the next day with a few of his buddies. They go into this cave, and they find a broken piece of pottery, and in that pottery is a leather scroll. They don't know what this is. They take it. They try to say, you know, who can we bring this to? And they go to Hebrew University, to Professor Zukenik, the father of Yigal Yadin. And they say, hey, we found this. And he looks at it, and he recognizes that this is something authentic. He doesn't know exactly what it is yet. He realizes that this is authentic, that this is real. And he purchases this scroll from them, and over the next couple of years, purchases a number of other scrolls from that area. Now, appreciate, at this point, this part of modern-day Israel is not Israel, it's Jordan. So Jordan eventually realizes what's going on, and they realize, well, wait, we don't want to let these scrolls keep on leaving, right? These are things that we want to preserve, things that we want to study, because they clearly have great value. And we'll talk about what happened. But over the past number of years, they've continued to find caves, and at this point, I believe 11 caves have been found. And when, just for your understanding, whenever you see references to Dead Sea Scrolls, it always starts out with 1Q or 2Q or 10Q. That refers to which cave it was. Was it cave 1 of Qumran? Was it the fourth cave of Q for Qumran? And then it'll tell you a number. And that number identifies a particular scroll or a fragment in the order in which it was found. So it could be 4Q 345, and that'll be the 345th either scroll or fragment. They found 800 scrolls and thousands of fragments of parchment there, pertaining to many different things. As it turns out, it seems that it wasn't necessarily a library. They didn't find a library. It seems that these things were hidden, that they appreciated that these cliffs are not easily accessible. This wasn't a place where, you know, people would go to, you know, for some, you know, some quiet time with the parchment. I mean, these were things clearly they were sort of put to the side for preservation purposes. As an aside, we don't really know what happened to the people of Qumran. They seem, and we'll talk about why this is, it'll make sense as we go through, but it seems that after the destruction of the temple, they're no longer. And it's not necessarily that they were killed in the battles, but we'll talk about why that may have sort of made their community ultimately disappear. But clearly, there was some type of intention on their part to say, you know, hey, we need to preserve, we need to have some kind of preservation of these important documents. But just to sort of go through the story, because it's an interesting story, and it's worthwhile to know about, is that at that point, so Jordan decides, okay, we're going to take these scrolls. We're not going to let any more get into Hebrew University. And they decide, though, obviously this is an important discovery. They assemble a team of international scholars whose job, together with Oxford Press, whose job it's going to be is to research these scrolls and to start systematically publishing their findings. What happens is that nothing is published, or very few. Over a period from 1950 until 1991, I think 8 volumes are published of Dead Sea Scroll documents. You should be aware that now there's about 25. So, meaning until that point, there was very little research that was done, and it brought about a lot of questions as to what exactly was going on, and lots of theories. Some are saying they're not publishing material because there's something in there which might disprove Christianity, and therefore they're not publishing it. Or it might be there's something that it disproves the Bible, disproves Judaism, and that's why. Nobody knew exactly what was going on, why it wasn't being published. And during that time, there were actually books. Perhaps you've seen them. There were books written during that time about theories. You know, about what was going on, right? These books sort of saying, you know, they're not writing, they're publishing because of this. And all these books are coming out trying to get to the bottom of what's going on with the lack of publishing of the Dead Sea Scrolls. What changed? 1991, things changed. So there was an important event that took place in 91. Anybody remember? What took place in 91? As far as Israel's concerned.
The Gulf War.
Right, the Gulf War. That's when the Gulf War was. Now, I'll just mention that the Dead Sea Scrolls were kept in Rockefeller Museum, which is in East Jerusalem. Now, post-67, and we'll sort of go back, and I'll mention, the reason it seems that these documents weren't published is not because they disproved Christianity, not because the reason these documents weren't published is because they didn't know what they said. They didn't understand what they were being read. They put together this international team of scholars, but there was one nation which was not part of this, team. As it turns out, a lot of the documents are written in Aramaic, Aramaic similar to what you'd find in the Talmud and so on, and there was a difficulty. They had a difficulty in really interpreting and figuring out what was going on. Story goes is that they opened up one scroll and they see that the first words are Nachamu, and they don't know what that is. So if I were to ask you, what did they find? They found Yeshaya, right? They found Isaiah, right? Nachamu, Nachamu. I mean, they looked at it. They said, I don't know what this is. They opened up a concordancia. They find the word Nachamu. They see Nachamu's in Isaiah. And they say, oh, we found the book of Isaiah. But any Jewish person would have looked at it and immediately known exactly what it is. So obviously there wasn't that team of experts working on it whose language, whose entire history of learning was the same as these texts. And so they had difficulty in publishing them. However, post-1967, where even these all these documents are brought into the hands of Israeli control, so Israel does what they did with everything post-67, is they continue to respect all agreements that Jordan had established prior to 67. So that impacts, to this day, what goes on the Temple Mount, but also impacted these scrolls. So Israel continues to respect that. In 1991, as war looms in the Middle East, Israel gets together with Jordan and says, listen. Jordan comes to Israel and says, listen, we're concerned that maybe there'll be a war and maybe these documents will be destroyed. And what a loss it would be to the world of knowledge to lose these documents after they've been preserved for 2,000 years. And so they decided that they're going to make copies of every single scroll, and they would, in fact, they would make 5 copies of the scroll, and they would take these sets of copies and put them into 5 different museums around the world. And that way, God forbid there was a war and the real ones would be destroyed, there at least would be facsimile copies of these scrolls placed throughout the globe and they'd be preserved. They signed deals with the libraries where they put the documents, saying that the only time they were ever allowed to even let known public that the scrolls were there, let alone actually let people see them, would be if, in fact, there was a war and the real documents were destroyed. If not, they had no right to publish them, right? There was a team whose responsibility that was. Over the years, there was one particular fellow, a person by the name of Herschel Shanks, who the editor of Biblical Archaeology, who wrote for a decade, you know, constantly about this atrocity of the lack of publishing of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So apparently in one of the libraries where the scrolls were kept in California, maybe not the safest place to keep the scrolls, but one of the places they kept the scrolls was in a library in San Marino, California. One librarian there had been reading. He knew that they had the scrolls there, and he says, I don't care about any agreement that our library made. He goes, the world needs to know that these documents are there. So he calls a press conference and announces to the world that anyone who has a valid library card is more than welcome to come and peruse the Dead Sea Scrolls. At that point, Israel and Jordan very quickly try to assemble their legal team together, but takes time to do those things. And at that point, people have been looking at the scrolls anyway, so Israel said, fine, the jig is up. They took back all the scrolls. They said, we're disbanding that international team. We're creating our own international team. They are a new team, probably primarily of Jewish scholars. I believe it was 70 scholars that they gave all the scrolls to. And they told each scholar, you have 3 years to publish your documents, and we're going to take them back and give them to somebody else. And so from 1991 forward, everything has been, basically everything has been published, the scrolls as well as the fragments. And so because of that, it's a very fresh field. We were only talking about 15 years old since such a large majority of the findings have been published. I mentioned there's about 25 volumes of it. Only 8 had been, published until that point. And so there's a lot of data that all of it has been looked at, but not necessarily all of it has been fully appreciated and sifted through to get the full brunt of exactly what the implications are of all of these documents. So that's the basic story of the Dead Sea Scrolls and sort of where in the world of studies of these important works, where we are today. If you just want to see, if you open up your source book to the inside page, I have a map here. It sort of shows you where Qumran is in context of the rest of Israel. You can see it's right on the top of the Dead Sea, right to the western edge of the Dead Sea, east of Yerushalayim, south of Yericho. It's right over there. Those are hilly areas that are along the sea. Just also point out, we'll sort of make reference to this a little bit later, but if you look on the top, these also sort of put some important dates here as they relate to the time of Bayit Sheni, to the Second Temple period. Phil mentioned last week, they're getting a little confused with the date. So just so you have here sort of when the Second Temple is built. That's according to secular sources. Jewish tradition has it a little bit different. But then the other dates are certainly all agreed upon as far as when Alexander the Great conquered that part of the world, when the Maccabees defeat the Greeks, when the Romans sort of come make their way in and take control of the area, and then finally the Korban, the destruction, in 70 of the Common Era. Okay, and we'll refer back to those dates. Will become relevant as we discuss things a little bit later. So the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we're talking a lot about where they come from. But the reason that it is so important is because they do shed a lot of light, and they shed a lot of light on a number of different. For each religious group, they have a lot to share. And so if you look on your class outline, so in 3 it says Dead Sea Scrolls contribute to the knowledge of the Pharisees. We talk about Pharisees, we talk about Purushim, we talk about the rabbinic tradition that we are descended from. One of the discoveries that they had at Qumran, in addition to scrolls, is that they found tefillin. In fact, they found some old pairs of tefillin that were at that time. So if you're wondering if that was a creation in the Middle Ages, no, it's not. They found it in the Middle Ages, looking just like we have. And you might be wondering, if you were to find a pair of tefillin that were 2,000 years old, so there's probably one question that you would have about these tefillin. Are they Rashi or Rabbeinu Tam? So for those of you who are not familiar with the question, there's a dispute among the medieval commentaries, Rashi and Tosfot, you'll learn about next year in Sfarim Bashanah, more about who Rashi and Tosfot were and what made them so important. But there's a dispute as to, there's 4 pieces of parchment that are found within the tefillin shalrosh, within the tefillin that one wears on the head. Now, there's a question as far as what order should they be put in. Should they be placed in the order in which they're found within the Torah, or are they based on a different order, more based on thematic flow of information? That's a dispute that takes place. It's one of those disputes that you think about, you always wonder, where did that come from? Open up their tefillin and look. Why is it the fact that there's such a machlokas? So there's different theories. Some say maybe the wearing of tefillin had actually almost ceased within Jewish communities, and they were igniting it, and so there was... So what did they find in Qumran?
Neither of them.
They found both. They found one according to the opinion of Rashi, and they found the according to the opinion of Tosafot. So this is a very old dispute. This was an old dispute. They could have opened up the Tefillin. They would have found both. Meaning this is a very old dispute that we have information dates back to the times of Qumran. So the fact that Rashi and Tosafot argue about it, it's because it's an old machlokas. It's a very old dispute. So just that, you know, gives you like an appreciation of like how amazing it is, this discovery that we have, that you know, we had no idea what was going on. And to find these old tefillin was tremendous. It was obviously an absolutely tremendous discovery. We talk about sectarian Jews. Talk about early Jewish communities or breakaway sects of Judaism. So there's lots of documents in here that tell us about their lifestyle, the way that they lived, and the ways that they lived that were different from us. And it sort of presents a lifestyle which we really almost viewed as not part of a Jewish way of life, but a very ascetic type of lifestyle, a way that we maybe normally associate with certain Christian movements. Famous people, you know, the guy who buried himself in the ground, or the person who sat on top of a pillar for 50 years, right? All these famous stories within the Christian tradition about people who lived very ascetic lifestyles. So, in fact, we find that there was an entire Jewish community that themselves had embraced such a way of life. And so we learn a lot about an entire community that we knew there were sectarian communities, but we didn't really know so much about them. We'll talk about them. I mean, we had some sources in Josephus, which we'll see. There's sources in the Talmud, which we'll see. But that's it. We certainly didn't have any of their documents. We didn't have any documents that, at least not that we realized were their documents. We didn't have any documents that showed us the way that they perceived themselves, the way that they present. Meaning, we maybe have documents that made fun of them, that put down what they were doing. But here we have documents that talk about, from their perspective, what it was that they were going to do. And so it really sheds light on an entire way of life that had become hidden from us over the millennia. And then certainly the Dead Sea Scrolls, and again, that's why it's interesting, is because really everyone who studies the scrolls sort of studies them from their perspective, but Christianity also has adopted the scrolls as an early Christian type of movement, and that the community of Qumran, in fact, shared values that ultimately would be the values, or that you see that there were values that existed that were the values of early Christianity. Certainly we talk about asceticism, right? That's something that ultimately is adopted by Christianity. They say, oh, you know, see, the Dead Sea Scroll shows proof that this is something that was very ancient. What's significant is one particular find that they found there, which is a document which is known as the Son of God scroll, and in which it talks about that God says that it's written, you know, that God says, I'll send, you know, you the Son of God, and the people will be redeemed, and so on. And what's interesting is obviously that has very strong Christian overtones to it, this concept of a Son of God. Not that it doesn't exist within Tanakh, it does exist within Tanakh in Sefer Yeshaya, and over there it's dealt with as far as how do we have a term of Son of God, and we understand that it refers not to a person, but it refers to the Jewish people, it refers to Israel as an entity. But what's interesting is that it's found within these documents there, and you sort of have two different approaches that have been taken with it. Some have taken it to say, look, Christianity's right. And don't even tell me that the Christians came up with it, because I can show you that it predates, that it comes even earlier, that even Jews were believing in this concept that there would be a Son of God, that there would be a flesh and blood Son of God. What's interesting is sort of the other perspective which is taken. In fact, this is almost an approach which is taken by Christians, that they say that they're actually a little wary of this document, because if anything, it almost implies that it was an idea that was out there, and simply perhaps they borrowed it, or they almost created this picture of Jesus based on pre-existing things that were out there. Meaning, if you have this approach, no one had ever heard of this, and all of a sudden there is this person who clearly is the Son of God. So that's much more miraculous than saying, you know what, people have been talking about such a thing, and what do you know? Hey, you know, they start saying, oh, this is the guy who it is. It gives it a little bit less, from one perspective, a little bit less credibility, when you could simply be is that they needed to find some type of religious framework with which to buttress their support for their leader, and so they borrowed an idea that was already out there, but perhaps it wasn't as compelling in of itself, but simply because there was an idea out there, it was easy to sort of draw the connection between them. Yeah, you have a question?
The scrolls and the details and the artifacts that they found, were they from a particular time, or do they themselves also span?
They span. Well, so how when they span, they end at the destruction of the temple, and they predate that for about 200 years. So about a 200-300 year time period. And so there's a lot of information here that a lot of different people study for understanding many different things. As we mentioned, till now, our interest is in Judaic studies. Our interest is what can we learn about Judaism from the scrolls themselves. In fact, there is a great deal that we can learn from them. We can learn a lot about biblical studies, and we're going to talk about that based on what we found there of Tanakh, as far as what we found, what we didn't find, surprises, and so on. And we'll talk about those variations in the text that we have for Tanakh. That's an important discussion that has to be raised based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. What it tells us about Jewish law. There's a lot of documents in there that talk about their practice of law, and sort of what it tells us about the way that Judaism was practiced at that time is important for us to sort of deal with the questions of, you know, did the rabbis, you know, somehow develop Jewish law on their own at a late time, or what does this tell us about perhaps earlier developments of Jewish practice? And then just general issues of history that it sheds a light onto some of the political events that took place during that time period. So in order for us to do this, in order for us to properly study the scrolls, we first need to sort of identify who exactly that community was. And if you look at your outline cover, we're already down, we're moving along, but we're getting into now the meaty part. In five, there's a bunch of options that are there, meaning it's inconclusive. It's inconclusive exactly who they are, and there's a lot of debate. Lauren Schiffman has one perspective, others have different perspectives. As we're going to see, it's not going to make such a big difference for our discussion, but just to sort of go through, is that some say that who are they? They're the early Christians, right? That's sort of something that we've spoken on. They say, you know, these are the early Christians. There's those who say they are the Sadducees, that they are the Tzedukim, and we'll talk about what exactly that would mean. There are those who say that they are the Essenes. The Essenes are a group which are found within Josephus, and we'll talk about who they are. And there are those who say some entirely other group, which we don't have any documented reference to them. That's who they were. They're not the groups that Josephus mentions of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, or the Essenes, but that they're a totally other group that lived during that time. Certainly, everyone agrees is that they have Jewish roots. It is a sect of Judaism. That's positive, right? That's 100%. It's not even a question. There's a question of who exactly are they. So what we sort of need to do is to sort of look at these groups and get an understanding of, you know, who were the Tzedukim, who were the Essenes, and from that we can try to play that game, or at least to sort of let you be aware of the issues that are involved in trying to identify exactly who these people were. So when we think about Tzedukim, if I were to ask you, who are Tzedukim? Tzedukim refer to Sadducees. Sadducees is the term that Josephus uses. Tzedukim is a term which is the Sadducees, which we find within Talmudic literature, right? That we find within rabbinic literature that refers to a group of people. And we have a tradition as to who the Tzedukim were. And so that we find on page number one within your sources. This is taken from, based on what it says in Perkei Avot, and then ultimately what it says in Masechet Rabbi Nasan, which is also a Mishneh type of text. We're going to learn about a little more what these type of texts are next year, but it elaborates a little bit on who these people are. So we have a discussion very at the very beginning of Perkei Avot. It says, Antigonos Yishtovu Kibel Mishimon HaTzadik, that there was this person, Antigonos, who received from Shimon HaTzadik, from Simon the Just, and Hua Yeomer, he used to say, Al Tu Kavadim Mishamshin Esarav Amenas Lakal, for us one should not be a servant who serve their master in order to receive a reward, right? Do a mitzvah because you say, ooh, ooh, I'm going to get a prize. Rather, a person should be like a servant who serves their master not for the purpose of receiving rewards, rather for the purpose of doing it because you believe in your master, right? Because that's what you believe you're supposed to do. Be morish raim aleichem, you should have fear of heaven upon you. So it says in Rabbi Avos Rabbi Nassan, it takes the statement from this teaching of Antigonos and elaborates or sort of talks about the aftermath of this teaching. So it says, Antigonos yishok ayelo shnei talmidim. It says that Antigonos had two students, shonin bidvarav, that they would study his words. And it was taught from student to student to student. Amdu v'dikniku acharehem. They went and they tried to precisely interpret the words of Antigonos. V'amru mara u avotenu lomar davar zeh. I said, why did our teachers, right? Why did our fathers teach this statement? And we're in source number two. Why did they teach this? Esher shiyasa pol malacha kol hayom v'lo yitel scharo arvit. Is it possible that a person would work all day and not get paid at night? Meaning, why would anyone do that? I mean, why would he say, don't serve for reward? Who serves for without a reward? I mean, that sounds ridiculous. Ella, ilu hayodin avasin shiyesh olam acher. Rather, if our forefathers knew that in fact there was another world, the yesh tkiyat ha-meitim, and there was resurrection of dead, lo hayu omrim kach. They wouldn't have ever said this. Meaning, what did they say? They said, you know, why did they say this? Because there is no reward. That's why they made the statement, because they didn't believe in any of these things. So amdu pirshu min ha-Torah. So they went and said, you know what, if there's no reward, we're out of here, right? We're done. V'nifritzu me'am shtei prutzot, and they formed two groups, tzidukim v'baitusim. Two groups that are mentioned within this Mishnaic literature, the tzidukim, the Sadducees, and the baitusim. Tzidukim al-shum tzadok, Baitus al-Shem Baitus, right? Why are they called Tzedukim? Because they had a teacher whose name was Tzedok. Why are they called Baitusim? Because they had a teacher the name of Baitus. Vayimishdamshim, and it talks about what they did. So basically, it talks about where did the Tzedukim come from? They come from a sect who had theological problems with the establishment, and that's what inspired them to break away and to sort of start their own community. So that's the tradition that we have as far as the source of this group. Certain scholars, historians, identify another reason. In fact, it may be correct. Both may be correct. They both sort of share on a similar idea as far as where the Tzedukim come from. So look over here. Look in source number three. We're on the second, this page two. It says, this is a pasuk from Yechezkel, from Ezekiel. It says, V'nasat el kohanim halavim asharheim mizera tzadok hakrovim elainu mashem lokim l'sharseini parvim bekar lechatat. That you shall give the priests, the Levites that are of the seed of tzadok, who are near unto me to minister unto me, says Lord God, young bullock for a sin offering. So here in Yechezkel, meaning a text which is from Vayechin, from the first temple period, that what was the family of kohanim that served within the temple? The family of Tzadok. That Tzadok was was a Kohen Gadol, and that it was his descendants that were the Kohanim that were in charge of what took place within the Beis HaMikdash. And so some say that who are the Tzedukim? They are descendants of this Tzadok, not Tzadok, the student of Antigonos, but in fact Tzadok, the Tzadok from Bayis Rishon. And in fact, we do know that many of the Tzedukim were priests. That's something that we had seen last week, that they were from the class of the Kohanim. We talk about they were oftentimes the aristocracy, that were in fact the group of the Kohanim. And so it actually does seem to fit quite well. In fact, that would be the question. That's why they're called Tzedukim, because they come from Tzadok. The question comes is, why did they break away? Fine, they're from Tzadok, but what does that have to do? So one of the reasons may be that there were theological differences, as the Mishnah implies, that was part of the reason they broke off. But in fact, there's another reason which is suggested. And this is a letter we're going to look at a little bit later, but there's a letter that they found within the Dead Sea Scroll documents, which is known as the MMT Scroll. It was found in the fourth cave. MMT stands for Miksat Maasei Torah, a little bit of the words of the Torah. And it's a letter which is written from the head of the Dead Sea Scroll community to the Kohen Gadol. It's amazing. His letter, which is written to the Kohen Gadol, saying, this is why we're breaking away. This is why we've decided to leave. And it identifies areas of halacha where they say, you're doing it wrong. You're defiling the temple. You're ruining the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, we're out of here. Therefore, we're breaking away and we're starting our own sect. That document is dated to about the year 150 BCE. Now, if you look on your calendar or on your dates, what event is that following? 150 BCE. Right, Hanukkah. So what happens in Hanukkah?
The Maccabees.
The Maccabees. Who are the Maccabees? The Maccabees are Kohanim. Are the Maccabees from Tzadok?
No.
The Maccabees are not from Tzadok. They're from a different family of Kohanim. But what do we know? That who becomes the Kohen Gadol after the victory of the Maccabees? One of the Maccabees, right? One of their sons and ultimately their grandson. They become the Kohen Gadol. So it's very likely that here you have this group, this family that says, hey, we're supposed to be the Kohen Gadol. We're the ones who are supposed to be determining what happens in the Beis HaMikdash. The Maccabees come along and say, listen, we won the war. We're the pious ones. We're the ones who are following the Torah. You guys, you are becoming influenced by the Greeks. You've corrupted the service in the temple. You know what? We're not appointing you. We're going to appoint from our own family as the protectors of the Beis HaMikdash. So at that time, a group decides, you know what? We're breaking away. We're leaving. And so they move out. They leave Jerusalem. And they move out into this area. They also become a political force that fights against the Purushim. There's lots of discussion. We'll learn about that next week. We're talking Megillat Tanit of the great disputes, and they were not just halachic or theoretical, but they in fact were bloody battles that took place between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, between the Tzedukim and the Purushim. And so it seems that the story of Hanukkah, which we celebrate as a great event, certain Jews viewed as a very negative event, because that was the time that the Beis HaMikdash was taken over by the family of the Maccabees. Okay, so that sort of tells us, also gives us a sense about when it took place. It's sort of the Tzedukim, maybe there was already a group that was developing before the story of Hanukkah, but the story of Hanukkah made a large impact on what, and ultimately the structure, the schism that took place within the Jewish community at that time. Yes. They were priests, but they weren't the high priest. They weren't the high priest necessarily, and that's what's so significant about it. Right? That in theory would be so significant. They said maybe we should be appointed the high priest. And we know that over the generations, again, this is something we'll talk about next week, is that there were times that the Tzedukim were appointed the high priest over the next period of time. And so this was an ongoing battle, but this may have been part of the influence which drove them to break away. And if we identify the second Qumran as Tzedukim, this would explain sort of what was going on over there. Yes?
Just wondering, the word Purushim seems to be to separate.
Yes.
So that means they were separate from the main body? Of
it doesn't mean main body. It might be that we separated from things that were impure. That mean we maintained a certain level of sanctity. That we differentiated between that which was permitted and that which was prohibited, between what was mutter and asr. I mean, necessarily separating from the community. It means more that we differentiated. Right? We had a very developed legal system that, as you all know, that sort of said, you know, this you can eat, this you can't eat, right? This you can do, this you can't do, right? We were Purushim. We were ones who separated between things.
Is that also possibly the idea that second base of Megiddo had no Shechina?
Well, there's a whole discussion about that, but that goes even earlier than this, right? This is going to go back. The Beis HaMikdash, as we see from the dateline, has been around for a long time, right? It's been around for a long time. But that is part of it, that we don't view the temple as having had the same sanctity as it had earlier. Yeah?
I don't know if this is true or not.
Maybe.
Don't the Tzedukim served on the Sanhedrin.
That's not a theory. It's true. It's true. It's absolutely true.
So the Purushim and the Tzedukim served together in the Sanhedrin?
Again, we're going to talk about more next week about the issues that went on, but it was a politically, there was lots of turmoil that took place during that time period. Okay. Okay, so that's one theory which is suggested for who the second Qumran is, and it's not so ridiculous. Now, one thing that we find is Josephus describing the Sadducees, and he also describes another group, the Essenes. And when he tells us about the Essenes, though, it sounds a lot like what we know about the Jews of Qumran. Look at source number 4. Can somebody read, please? Raise a hand. Yes, thank you.
So there are three philosophical sects among the Jews. The followers of the first of which are the Pharisees, of the second the Sadducees, and the third sect, which pretends to a severer discipline, are called Essenes. These last are Jews by birth and seem to have a greater affection for one another than the other sects have. These Essenes reject pleasures as an evil, but esteem continence and the conquest over our passions to be virtue. They neglect wedlock, but choose out other persons' children while they are pliable and fit for learning, and esteem them to be of their kindred and form them according to their own manners. They do not absolutely deny the fitness of marriage and the succession of mankind, thereby continued, but they guard against the lascivious behavior of women and are persuaded that none of them preserve their fidelity to one man.
Okay, so here we have, right, a very ascetic lifestyle being put forward. And certainly what we know about the Jews of Qumran, they're living in caves, right? they're not shopping at Tiffany, right? Meaning, right, they're living very ascetic types of lifestyles. And so one might say, you know, maybe this seems, you know, that's who really are the people living in Qumran. Now, we have from their documents that we found where you find in their documents rejection of marriage. And so it would seem to fit with what we find, because we don't know that Tzedukim did not reject marriage. At the same time, we also did find some documents among the Dead Sea Scroll community that they accept marriage as well. And so then you sort of wonder, well, okay, so then maybe they're not the Essenes. But look, someone read the next paragraph. This is skipping a little bit further within Josephus. Thanks.
Moreover, there's another order of the Essenes who agree with the rest as to their way of living and customs and laws, but differ from them in the point of marriage, as thinking that by not marrying, they cut off the principal part of human life, which is the process of succession. They, rather, that if all men should be of the same opinion, the whole race of mankind would fail. However, ladies, they try their spouses for 3 years, and if they find that they have their natural foundations right as trials that are likely to be fruitful, they are with child as a demonstration.
Yeah,
is right? That they actually marry them, but they do not use to accompany with their wives when they are with child as a demonstration that they do not many.
They're probably married.
Now the women go into the baths with some of their garments on, as the men do with somewhat girded around. Again, something, I guess, girded about them. And these are the customs of this order.
Right, so we see that even within the scenes there was sort of this different opinion. And again, that sort of fits with what we found in Qumran, that there are some documents that reject marriage, some documents that say it's okay. But among the Sadducees, we don't know that they rejected marriage at all. And so some would say, you know, that implies that the scenes are really the community that we found, that were the ones that were living in Qumran. What's interesting is that within Talmudic literature, just like in Josephus, there's three groups of Perushim, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. There's also three groups that are found within rabbinic literature. We find the Perushim, we find the Tzedukim, and we find the Baitusim. And so some wonder, who are these Baitusim? Who are these Baitusim? So part of us wants to say, well, I don't know, there's three and three, the first two match up. Maybe Baitusim are the Essenes. But we don't necessarily have a basis to say that. So the next verse I'm going to show you actually sort of implies that maybe that is true. This is a Tosefta, also Mishneh literature. Again, something we'll learn about next year in Svarim Bashanah. But here it says that it talks about the Vaitusim. This is a critical edition of it that was printed by Saul Lieberman. And it gives us insight into who they were. So I'll just talking about the laws of Sukkos. It doesn't matter exactly what they were, but there was a dispute between the Purushim and the Vaitusim. And so it says over there that Ma'aseh, that there was a story, the Kavshu Alev Vaitusim, the Vaitusim came and did something. Within one of the earliest references or earliest texts that we have of the Tosefta, you can read through exactly what the discussion is over there, but Vaitusim is actually split into two separate words. It's split into the word Beit, and it's split into the word Sin, meaning the house of Sin. Now, in early Hebrew, something you find within the Jerusalem Talmud quite often, which again is the place where Tosefta is written in the land of Israel, is that the Aleph is often dropped. So, while in, let's say, the in the Talmud Bavli, you might have a Rebbe Abba, in Yerushalmi, that same person will be referred to as Rebbe Ba. Right, the first Aleph is dropped. That was just the manner, the way that they spoke to people. And so it could be that Beit Sin is really Beit Asin, right? Beit Asin. And so it could be that the Vaitusim actually match up quite well with the Essenes, and that maybe then you would say then that the Vaitusim that we have referred to within the Mishnah, whatever tells us about them, would also be telling us about the Jews in Qumran. We could actually compare those texts one to another. In any case, there's a big dispute exactly who they are, and it's been going on for many years, and sort of I think the arguments even stopped because everyone realized that nobody could really prove one way or the other. What does come out is that the group in Qumran was certainly an ascetic group, was certainly a sect of Judaism. It certainly was somehow in one form or another related to the Tzedukim, related to the Essenes, related to the Vaitusim. Whether they are that exact group or not, that's a discussion. But they certainly were some form, some similar type of group. So then it's something that sort of comes up is that we can go ahead and we can take things that we have within the Talmud that refer to Tzedukim and Vaitusim and do discussions with it as regards to the Dead Sea Scrolls, because the same type of group, even if they're not exactly the same. That's something we're going to do in just a little bit. What I want to do now is sort of jump into discussions of Judaic studies, really get into a meaty discussion of exactly some of the issues that arise. And I want to focus on two things. I want to talk about its impact on biblical studies, on the study of Tanakh, and then its impact on the study of Halakha. So let's look at source 6. Source number 6 is from the Gemara in Brachos. And Gemara in Brachos is talking about Asher. Right? Asher is something that we say 3 times a day. The statement right before the one that I quoted here tells us that it's a great thing to say Asher 3 times a day. And it says over here that if you ever noticed, Asher is the first letter of each sentence is another letter of the alphabet, right? Aleph, right, goes alphabet. There's one letter which is missing. There's one line which is missing in Ashrei, and that's the nut. The nut is not there. So the Gemara recognized that, and it said, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan, you name Malo Nemer Nun Ba'Ashrei. Why is there no Nun sentence in Ashrei? So they answer, you name Sheish Ma Mafaltan Shalsoni Yisrael, because the Nun is reminiscent of the falling of. It says the wicked, the haters of Israel, it really means of Jews, meaning they don't want to say something negative about Jews, but there is a pasuk that starts with a nun that talks negatively about the Jews, and therefore we don't want to have any reference to it within Asher. What's the pasuk? The pasuk is, Naflo lo tosif kum betula Yisrael, that the one who has fallen will never get up again. And so therefore we don't have the nun. It's an interesting argument. There's many pasukim that talk about negative things that we don't cut them out of Asheri also. So look at the other packet that you have now. This is from one of the scrolls that were taken at from Qumran. This is from some of the Psalm scrolls. And here we have Ashrei, right? Here we have Ashrei. And among Ashrei that we have right here, you'll see underlined a pasuk. You'll see underlined a pasuk. So look at the first word. The Hebrew text that takes a little bit of getting used to just because it's a slightly different than we do, but then want to see what that first word says? Ne'eman. It says Ne'eman. What's the next word? It's underlined. It's in the middle of the page. It's underlined. Elohim. What's the next word? Did Varav Vechasim Vechol Ma'atzah. Right, God is faithful in His words, and He is pious in all of His deeds. Right? That sounds great. That sounds like that fits right in. And so, in fact, so some say, you know what? There really was a nun. And here it is. And in fact, in the Septuagint, there is a nun. And so some say, you know what? So our tradition is perhaps incorrect. Now, the one argument people have to say, you know what? Maybe they really stuck it in because they were bothered that it wasn't missing there, is the term that uses for Elohim. If you look throughout this page over here, whenever it refers to God, it uses a different name for God. It doesn't use the name of God Elohim, but whenever within Asher we refer to to God, we use the four-letter name of God. We use Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. This is the one pasuk where it's different. This is the one pasuk where they use Elohim. So that causes some eyebrows to be raised and say, you know what? That doesn't really sound... That seems odd. Why should this one pasuk be the one that's different? Maybe, in fact, it really doesn't belong here, and it was added in incorrectly. That's one sort of... These are the types of things that arise. Because when we talk about the study of Tanakh, the oldest Torah that we have goes back to the Middle Ages, and the oldest manuscript we have of the Torah goes back to the early Middle Ages. And so we really talk about the 8th century or so. We don't have anything that predates it. We don't have any documents. We have the Septuagints that have been written, but as far as Hebrew written Tanakh, we don't have anything older than that. So sort of biblical criticism has always just been based on literary analysis, and sort of reading it and trying to identify, based on literary techniques, whether or not one can identify anomalies. But for the first time, that people are actually taking now copies of Tanakh and saying, we don't need to do just literary analysis anymore. Let's just read what it says, and let's see if there's things are the same. Let's see if things are different. And in fact, it's raised a number of questions that we need to think about. They found all the books of Tanakh there. So that was pretty significant. All the books of Tanakh were found at Qumran, except for one. Wrote it on the front. The one book they didn't find is Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. And so that has brought speculation that, well, why didn't we find it there? It wasn't there, right? They didn't have it. And in fact, maybe it wasn't really part of Tanakh until a later time period. That's what some suggest based on the fact that it wasn't there. And it could be that there's actually some type of basis for that, even within our tradition. Look at source number 7. Here it says, Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel that Esther eino mitama esilam. He says that Esther, the book of Esther, if one has a scroll of Esther, that one's hands do not become impure if you touch it. What's this talking about? So it seems that at a certain point the rabbis were concerned that people were ruining their scrolls by touching them, and letters are getting erased. And so they said, you know, we need to stop people from sort of abusing their books. And so they said, if anybody touches them, their hands become impure. And that was a way of making sure that people wouldn't start fiddling around with their documents. So anything which we consider to be holy, the rabbi said, will make your hands impure. If the rabbis didn't believe it was holy, then they would say, it doesn't make your hands impure, because they didn't care if you touched it and it got ruined. So here he said that Esther does not defile your hands, meaning Esther is not holy. So then they said, "Lameimra de Savar Shmuel Esther la beruah hakodesh namra." Is it possible that Shmuel believes that Esther was not dictated with divine influence? Is that possible? So v'hamar Shmuel, but we know that Shmuel believes it was. Shmuel said, "Esther beruah hakodesh namra." We know that Shmuel does believe that it was divinely inspired. So therefore, the Gemara answers, well, what's going on with Shmuel? Why didn't he say it should defile your hands? Because he said, Nemro Likros, it was said by Ruach HaKodesh, it was a holy book, but it was never supposed to be written down. It was Nemro Likros, the Lord Nemro Lifna. It was only said in order to be read, it was never said to be written down. Maybe that's part of this concept we have in the Talmud of that the Torah Shebichtav is written, but the Torah Shebalpeh, the oral tradition, is not supposed to be written. And he thought it's part of the oral tradition that we have a scroll, and therefore it should be written down. So it could be the reason we don't find a written copy within the community of Qumran is because they said it shouldn't be written down. Not because they rejected it being holy, but because they rejected it being as a document. In fact, they actually have found, some have suggested, certain references within documents in there that sort of imply that they must have been aware of Megillat Esther, certain turns of phrase and so on that are borrowed from Megillat Esther that show that they clearly knew, they clearly were familiar with the work, even though they didn't have it there. And so don't tell me that it was only written in a later time. Clearly, it was written earlier. The fact they didn't have it doesn't necessarily tell you anything. Now, there are theories that say, no, they specifically didn't have it, but they chose not to have it. It existed at that time. They specifically chose not to have it. It was written down. That was what most of everyone wrote down in the scroll, but they rejected the Book of Esther. So why would they reject the Book of Esther? So anybody heard of, there's a kind of scroll that we call the Hamelech scroll? Anybody heard of a Hamelech scroll? What is that? That the beginning word of each column is Hamelech. Why would we start the king? Why would we start each scroll with the word the king? It's pretty, but why would we do that? Why? Right. Why do we need in the Esther, in Book of Esther, a hidden reference to God? Every time it says the king, oh, it refers to God. Because God's name is never mentioned in all of the Book of Esther. So it could be they said, them being so pious, saying, this book doesn't even say God's name in it. This is going to be part of our holy books? No way. And so they rejected it as part of a holy book. And so the reason it's on there isn't because it didn't exist. It was simply because they rejected it. They said, this can't be part of our religious tradition if God's name isn't mentioned there. So it's sort of interesting issues that are, yeah.
But they had Shiva, Shirim, and...
Everything else they have.
Yeah.
Right. So they have everything else. And again, there are those who have sort of proven that there are references to Megillat Esther already in their scrolls. So clearly it was already around. It clearly was already around at that time, even if they didn't have a written copy within their collection. Yeah.
You were referring to this. What is the fourth word? I see that it looks like a word that keeps repeating itself.
I think that's God's name. I think that's God's name. I think it's Yud-Kay-Vav-Kay. I'm pretty sure that's Yud-Kay-Vav-Kay.
You know, dots above and above.
Yeah, they're writing it in a different text of Hebrew. There's different texts of Hebrew.
I'm not sure everywhere else.
Right, there's different texts of Hebrew. So they're using a different version. That's a whole share on its own. It's about different variations of Hebrew text. Okay, so that's another issue. Now, another really interesting issue that comes up with the Dead Sea Scrolls is that they found all the books of Tanakh, but they're not exactly the way that we have them. There's different words that are used. They're not exactly the same that we have. And so, as a part of our tradition, as the Rambam had sort of codified it, that we say, right, that it's one of the, right, the animamins, that every word that we have is exactly the word that Moshe received at Har Sinai. The challenge to that is that here we find old, predates our versions that we currently have of Tanakh that are different from what we have. Sometimes it's a word which is different, like basically the same thing. And sometimes it's much more flowery. It adds a lot more information about it. And so this has brought rise to a whole question among the scholarly circles as to what exactly is going on. And so they identified that, in fact, there's three different varieties, and this is somewhat heretical, but we'll talk about what it exactly means, that there are three different varieties of Tanakh which were found. You have a type which is found within Egyptian communities. That's the Septuagint. The Septuagint is clearly seems to be one variety. You have the variety of Tanakh, which is what they call the Masoretic version, that from the Masorah, that of what we consider to be holy. And then what they call the sect of Qumran, which they sort of relate to the Samaritan versions of Tanakh. They call it the Proto-Samaritan text of Tanakh. And they in fact say, so someone would say, you know what? There were three different independent versions of Tanakh that were going on. A lot of scholars have rejected such a notion because it seems difficult that how exactly that would have taken place of three totally independent versions being written down, especially when Qumran is so close to Yerushalayim that, you know, that really we could identify this as, you know, that So I'll just take back the version we call the Masoretic text. They say that's where that's where they call the Babylonian version of Tanakh. They call Qumran the Palestinian, and they call the Septuagint the Egyptian. That's difficult because the Babylonian version is based on when we lived in Israel, right? That's where we lived in. So to say that that is a different version is somewhat difficult. And others raise other questions about exactly how different varieties could have even sort of cropped up in light of the fact that we don't have Tanakhs with lots of editing found on the pages that, you know, that somebody would have added in or not. And so there's different opinions about exactly what happened. I'd say the more traditional approach is to say that, you know what, no, there was a primary version. That was the version that was kept within the Beis HaMikdash. We have reference to that in Tanakh. And other communities, they were editing it. They were meaning that maybe there was a certain fluidity to Tanakh. It wasn't set down. And so different communities sort of took that fluidity and made different additions and so on to Tanakh as they went along. And it wasn't until a little bit of a later time that it was sort of said, no, this is what Tanakh is. But that it could be that the version that had been kept in Jerusalem over the years, that was really always sort of the base version. Again, it hadn't really been said, it hadn't been canonized that this is the version, but it was sort of, that was the one that had been going on. And while other communities had sort of been embellishing the text from time to time, this is the text that had sort of been preserved in more pristine form, and eventually that was the text that Chazal took and said, this is the text that we're going to accept. In fact, there are discussions within the Talmud that there was a time during Ezra where there were three different versions, and it said that he tried that were found in the temple itself, and he had to sort of figure out what exactly was the correct version. And so even within our Jewish and our Talmudic sources, there's issues. This isn't, you know, something they just found. That we know that there were issues as far as text is concerned, but our tradition tells us that the text that we have is in fact what we identified as being the most authentic version of that Tanakh. But I think it's important to be aware of this issue that has been brought up from what was discovered within Qumran. Yeah.
Are there significant differences within the Chumash itself?
Yeah, there are some differences, yeah. Again, they're all basically the same. But again, it's elaborations. It could be a story is not there. An entire story is there. But for the basic part, it's still, I mean, you recognize it. Oh, this is Tanakh. You just say, this isn't exactly the way I remember
itself,
it.
Not just the other books.
Yeah. Even the Chumash itself. So, yeah, that's an important issue to be aware of. Okay, any questions on that? Yeah.
I just want to go back a moment. With reference to Sefer Yad Esther, the rabbis made it a point to stress the importance of hearing every single word that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this was a reaction to those who said it's not merited.
Maybe. Possibly. I mean, there's psukim that they base different laws on, but it could be that's part of it. But, okay. Fine. Let's go on now. We have a little bit more time left. I want to quickly talk about sort of the impact on Judaic studies or on the history of Halakha, because that's an interesting issue. So this is all going to be based on one particular scroll that they found. This is on the inside pages you have right here called the Miksat Maaseh Torah scroll, the MMT scroll. This is that letter that I referred to earlier that was written from the head of the set of this group in Qumran to the head of the Kohen Gadol, to a person who was a Perushi, a Pharisee, where he identified, these are the areas of law that we disagree with you regarding. And as you would expect, that they'll have to do with issues of purity and impurity, as would have been relevant to this question of, you know, from one Kohen to another, this is where we think you're wrong. And what's interesting to identify is say, well, you know what, here we have a document telling us what the Perushim were doing, based on what they were told they were doing wrong, what the Perushim were doing in the year 150 BCE. And then what's worthwhile to do is to go ahead and say, well, let's look at our recordings of what we find in the Mishnah and say, is the law that we find in the Mishnah, is it in accordance with what the Perushim were doing wrong, right, back in the times of the Maccabees? And if, in fact, it matches up, that actually shows that while maybe only written down in the 3rd century of the Common Era, these laws, in fact, come much earlier. And in fact, as you might expect, it's fascinating to see, and this is, again, this is an entire area of study, that is what we do find time and time again. Sometimes in Mishnah, specifically where we say the Sadducees are wrong because they don't do this. Right? Sort of like the opposite of the letter that were written to us. The Mishnah is sort of doing the opposite thing. This is what the Sadducees do that's wrong. So look in your source booklet over here, please. We're on page 4. And this is a law that has to do with the para aduna, right? With the red heifer. So I'll just read it because we're sort of getting short on time in English. It says, if the red heifer would not go forth, she was not to be let out with the black heifer, so none may say they slaughtered a black heifer, not a red one. Nor may they send out with her another red heifer, like I say, they slaughtered two red heifers. But the Yozet is not because of this, regarding what people might say, because it is said, and she shall be brought forth, this implies alone. Meaning, we didn't do it alone because we're afraid of something else. It's because, no, that's the Bible says. It must be alone. Continuing on, that the elders of Israel used to precede them on foot to the Mount of Olives. And they had a mikvah right there. That's where they did that's where they would do the offering of the paraduma on Har HaZeitim. You can see the spot today. That's where they would do the shkita. That's where they would slaughter the red heifer. But they had a mikvah right there. So Mishnah tells, why did they have a mikvah right there? Why do they need a mikvah right there? Umitamin ha'yus ha'kohanim asori fesapara. They would go ahead, before the Kohen would go ahead and burn the paraduma, the Kohen had to be in a state of purity, they would go ahead and they would do something to make him tameh. Why would they make him tameh? Because they would then tell him, go in the mikvah. We want you to go in the mikvah and become tahor, become pure. Why do they do that? It seems ridiculous. It says, b'neha tzedukah, because of the Sadducees. Because the Sadducees of the opinion that a person needs to be pure for the purpose of doing, being involved in the slaughter of the red heifer, as we do. But they said it's not enough to simply go to the mikvah to be considered pure. A person needs to also have harav shemesh. They also have to have mikvah and then nightfall. Now, we have that concept within Jewish law, but the rabbi said that's not necessary when it comes to this aspect of purity. That additional purity is not required. And specifically to, you know, sort of stick it to the Sadducees or to prove to the community that we disagree with them, they would make the Kohen impure so that he would go to the mikvah, and without it ever becoming dark, they would have him do the service to show we reject that position of the Sadducees. So the question is, what was going on back then? So that we find a reference to this within the document that we have in front of us. Let me see now where it is. Let me find it. Yeah, it's in the paragraph over here. It's in page 363. This paragraph at the bottom right corner. Page 363. You can see the page at the top. So it says, now just so you should be aware, this is taken out of a book that Lauren Schiffman put together called Text and Tradition, a source reader for the study of Second Temple Rabbinic Judaism. It's a bunch of documents from that time period that he felt were important to study, and sort of is the reader that goes along with a book that he wrote on the topic. It's an interesting read called From Text to Tradition. If you're interested in these issues, this is a good book to read. So he it says over here, he had obviously translating it, it wasn't written in English. And also, in what pertains to the purity of the red heifer and the sin offering, and whoever slaughters it, and whoever burns it, whoever collects ash, and whoever sprinkles the water of irrigation, all these ought to be pure at sunset, so that whoever is pure sprinkles the impure. So what do they require? They require sunset, right? That's something that we see specifically in the document that they require. Why were they writing it to the head of the Beis Hamikdash, to the head of the Perushim? Clearly because they felt that he didn't accept that position. Meaning, he said, you don't require nightfall. And therefore, we specifically here identify correctly in our Mishnah that what we write in the Mishnah, in fact, we have proof from the Dead Sea Scrolls, was in fact the position of the Perushim all the way back in the times of the Maccabees. That in fact, we do, that's the way we pass in the Mishnah, in fact, that's the way we practice back then, that we do not require nightfall for the purity of slaughtering the para aduma. Okay? That's one example of a halakha. Let's look at another one. Look at source number 9. This is another. Now, again, these areas are a little bit esoteric just because we don't deal with purity and impurity like they did back then, where they had to deal with their working in the temple. But these were major issues at that time period. And so, you know, sort of relate to these issues as you would, you know, a difference in opinion as far as, you know, what's kosher and what's not. You know, that's the significance that it would be. You know, how do you celebrate Shabbos? Right? These are the same things, even if these aren't issues that we ourselves relate to so much anymore. So it says over here, it says, Omrim Tzidukim, the Mishnah states that the Sadducees believe that Kovlev Anu Alechem Perushim, that the Tzidukim yelled at the Pharisees, Shatamitarim Etanitzuk, because we say that something is Tahor with a broken stream. What's this referring to? It's referring to an issue where, let's say you have something, water, which is in a tame vessel, an impure vessel, and you have a vessel here which is pure. And you go ahead and you pour from your impure vessel into your pure vessel. So the question is, does your pure vessel become impure? So we said that, Tzidukim said, that they were upset at us because we said that as long as it's not, there's a break in the stream at some point, that the vessel beneath does not become impure. Right? It's broken. It's nitzuk. And therefore, the next vessel will be still pure. The Sadducees clear the opinion that that's not true. That if you pour from one to the next, the one that you're pouring into will in fact become impure as well. And the question is, again, was that always the case? Was that always the law? So look back in your sheets over here. Look on the bottom of page 364, the second to last paragraph. Page 364, second to last paragraph on that left-hand column. It says, and also concerning flowing liquids. We say that in these there is no purity. Even flowing liquids cannot separate unclean from clean because the moisture of flowing liquids and their containers is the same moisture. So they didn't accept that. They said if there is any flow from one to the next, it will make impure the thing that you're going into. Meaning, Purushim disagree with that. And they said, no, there is a possibility that it still could be Tahor, that it still could be pure. So is the statement in the Mishnah a new law that we had? Clearly not. I mean, clearly what is identified in this Mishnah that the Purushim believe, that the rabbis believe, that they postulate in this Mishnah, that a broken stream would be pure, that a stream would still render pure, was a position that we held already back in the times of the Maccabees. And so when we get into questions, and again, these are you know, sort of dirty words of, you know, rabbinic Judaism, referring to Judaism, you know, that there's a, you know, a biblical Judaism and a rabbinic Judaism, and that the Judaism that we observe today is based on, you know, sort of the way that the rabbis came along and the way that the rabbis interpreted it, well, that might be true, might not be true, but they didn't do it in the 3rd century. If they did it, they did it back 500 years earlier. And they at least were doing it already back in the times of Maccabees, as the Dead Sea Scrolls have proven that the laws we find in the Mishnah, in fact, are the laws that already were being observed by the Pharisees at the times of the Maccabees. So once you go back that far, so then, you know, scholars have to come up with, you know, they used to say, well, you know what, you know, the destruction of the temple, that made a break. That's why we started developing rabbinic Judaism. So now they have to figure out something else. If they want to reject Torah Shel Peh, the oral tradition, so they have to go ahead now and say, oh, it's, you know, it was the advent of the Maccabees, you know, that started rabbinic Judaism. You know, it's a game, because they don't want to accept oral tradition, which is something that we very much believe in. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact, help us buttress our belief in the antiquity of Torah Shel Peh, of the oral tradition, of our way of interpreting the written law within the Torah. So those are just a few examples. There's another one I didn't get to. Actually, it's spoken about on Shavuos this year, and sort of a little bit else. But that's another aspect, nothing that we get from the Dead Sea Scrolls that's important to us as Jews, is what it teaches us about Jewish law. In summary, to wrap up, because in 5 minutes it's going to be Mincha downstairs, which of course everyone is invited to at 8 o'clock. I just want to give everyone a chance to get down there. Is that Dead Sea Scrolls are probably the most significant discovery that's been made in the past 100 years. They have given us a wealth of information about a time period unknown to us, but not just a period that we didn't fully know about, but a time period that's so important to us because it is, was so important to the birth of Christianity, to the development of Judaism, and to an important time in our shift from the times of the destruction onwards, and what that tells us. These scrolls have been studied for many different reasons, as far from language to history to religion to theology and so on. And many different communities study them for different perspectives. What we tried to do tonight was to understand these texts for what they tell us about our tradition, particularly to talk about the things that they challenge our tradition with and sort of how traditional scholars, how really experts in the field, people like Lawrence Schiffman and so on, Professor Schneer Lyman, Jews who are cling to traditional Judaism, how they've dealt with, how they've responded to the questions of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I think have certainly given us a very strong manner and path of doing that. And we've also looked at the things in Dead Sea Scrolls that don't challenge us, but in fact support our tradition in a very meaningful and a very profound way. So I hope that was interesting to you. It's certainly been interesting to me. And next week I look forward to seeing you at 6:30. We're going to be studying Megillat Tanit, which is probably the least famous of all the works we're going to be doing. It's the most Jewish of all the works that we're going to be doing. But again, it's an important text as it predates, you know, later rabbinic texts and was written during this time of Mayachin. Have a good night, and again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.